my guest in the studio with me this afternoon is Tina Roach from the Cambridge Cookery School. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Mike.
How are you doing?
Very well, thank you.
That's good. That we've been having a little laugh about growing old.
Yes, as we assume it must be like. I mean, we wouldn't know.
Oh, well, this is true. This is true. Now, this afternoon, Tina, of course, comes in every month to have a regular chat about food and so forth. But an interesting topic, because Tina, of course, writes for the Cambridge News as well, an article. And in your article in October, you're talking about vitamin D, the intake of which is important to maintain healthy bones, of course, and teeth. You're saying that it's suggested to supply a protective effect against multiple diseases and conditions such as cancer, type 1 diabetes and multiple sclerosis. So clearly, very important thing that we get enough vitamin D. And you were saying in your article, now that we're moving into winter and the sun's getting weaker and whatever, I guess we're not out as much as we would be in the summer anyway. I guess we're not getting as much vitamin D. Yeah?
No, and I was being slightly cheeky there as well, you know, justifying my own sun worshipping, and of course, you know, we all know that too much sunshine or having too much of a hard tan or burning indeed is not good for us. But there's also now signs of the opposite effects, where, you know, particularly children are being protected to such a degree by their obviously loving and concerned parents, always putting them in sun suits, always wearing factor 50, that they have actually ended up with issues that are relating to too little.
We do this all the time, don't we? We always go too far one way and then we come back too far the other way. You know, you've got the same situation going on with all that Jimmy Savile stuff that went on a while back there, and you have it with other things too. And I mean, I can remember the mumps, rubella, and what was it, MMR injections.
Measles.
People went off that because they thought it was bad for them and so forth, but too far again. And I guess it's probably true here that you see people now, they're completely covered up, as you say, to avoid the sun.
No, I think sadly that's a trend for everything, isn't it? Driven by media and the internet, I think that we very quickly go down single issue lines, and, you know, all reason and all sort of surrounding and associated issues are quickly peeled away, and we're just looking at one isolated issue in itself, which is never the right way to look at anything, really.
Now, the great thing, though, from what you were saying in your article, is that if the sun's obviously going to be less of a contributor during the winter, there are ways to compensate it by your diet.
Absolutely. And I also think very neatly, they are exactly the kind of foods that one, or certainly I, crave when you go into the colder season, which is more rustic. You know, in the summer, I eat a lot of vegetables and fruit and salads, and we all do, don't we? Light things.
I call it rabbit food.
Yeah. Rabbit food, yes. Well, I quite like rabbit food, but I don't like it on a wet and cold November morning.
No, you know, absolutely.
October, this is unseasonally warm, isn't it? Normally we have colder weather by now. So it's moving into eating things like steak, preferably quite rare, livers, kidney, if you like that. I think that's a very old-fashioned thing to eat these days. Chicken liver, I love making chicken liver mousses and so on, very quick as well. Deep green vegetables, eggs, you know, again, not overcooked eggs. They always have wonderful vitamin. Full cornbread, which again is very, very healthy.
So that's interesting. You've mentioned rare meat and only just cooked eggs. So is the fact that you don't overcook it an important aspect to keeping the vitamin D within the food?
Just like you deplete a carrot by boiling it to within an inch of its life, you know, you are depleting the vitamin and nutrient levels are highest raw, actually, and then they deplete with increased cooking. That is part of the thinking, say, behind the raw food trend as well, which is a very extreme way of only accepting raw foods. But yes, the more you cook it, the less the vitamins will be there and be able to do anything good for you.
And I always worry about the whole idea of just cooking food so that it's rare. Presumably there's a point that you get to where if you didn't cook it enough, then it's potentially going to keep germs and whatever in it. So is there a point where you say it's okay to eat it now? You know, do you have to cook it for a certain length of time? Really?
You eat a steak tartare, don't you, which is raw steak chopped up with a raw egg yolk on top of it. You eat mayonnaise. If you make homemade mayonnaise, there's no stabilizers. It's not full of the chemicals that all your bought mayonnaise are to keep it for years, in fact. It's raw egg. If you eat sushi, it's raw fish. It's more a question of sourcing really good quality food and obviously how you keep it.
If
you
left it out
on your windowsill
in
the bleak winter sun for a few hours, that wouldn't be a great idea.
And I guess another one that springs to mind is red meat, steak in particular, or red meat generally. Nowadays, I think it's very commonplace to go into the supermarkets and see steak that will be actually branded as a 28-day aged steak and so forth.
Well, that's a complete just marketing thing. It doesn't really mean much.
Really?
But well-hung steak is definitely better. But the 28-day is how it hangs, etc. is not really... It's not what you think it is. When that label goes on, you suddenly... charged a lot more for what is essentially the same steak.
Okay, but the point is, one assumes that they are leaving it in the open, not frozen.
No, it's usually not. It's usually actually in a vacuum pack, which then stops the process slightly. If a proper butcher, of which there are very few, most butchers these days do not hang their own carcasses. They just don't have the room and the facilities. If you're on the high street and paying a lot of money, a lot of butchers do not have space to hang their own carcasses. So they come in halved or already butchered, usually into the joints that day. So the butchers are almost just vendors these days, with some exceptions, and they are wonderful. And if you're lucky enough to find such a butcher, stick with them, because not only will they know what they're doing, but the quality will be so much higher. So if you're hanging a carcass for a long, long time, then yes, you may get a surface that is getting moldy, for instance, mm-hmm. And it may have been in contact with flies, as you see, you know, in Southern Europe, and people are horrified.
Oh yes, you see under the glass counter, don't you? You often see flies crawling all over it, and I don't know if...
remove that surface. And inside you have a completely is the right word, anaerobic. You have an interior that has had no exposure to oxygen whatsoever. It will be exactly as it was when it was first hung.
So the fact that it hasn't been frozen or chilled. And perhaps even, as you say, the outside goes a little mouldy. So long as you take that off, the meat inside's still okay.
Mm. Not that is ever going to be an issue at home, because you don't see it, do you? You don't buy meat like that. Unless you are lucky enough to find a butcher still working like that, maybe in Southern Europe. But here, you're never going to see that. The butcher will have dealt with that for you. So he will be selling you pieces of meat that are completely safe. But if you were to walk into his cold store, because we're talking about hanging in a fairly chilled environment, you might look at it and say, that doesn't look right.
Well, no, this is what I was going to say.
Removed.
Exactly, because if you go into a supermarket or whatever, and if the packaging has been punctured, often the meat will start to go a colour that doesn't look very appealing. But I assume that even though it changes, not necessarily that example, but if the meat's hanging and it's changed colour from the bright red that we're normally used to something a lot darker and so forth, that doesn't necessarily mean that it's not acceptable to eat then, I assume.
No, not if it's been hanging. No, and obviously the longer something hangs, the more tender it's going to be and the more flavour it will have. And sadly, because of that, it's an expensive process. Every day that you have bought your stock, but you've yet not sold it, it's costing you money to keep it. Just as farmers now use growth hormones and then ensuing antibiotics to keep the animals well, in order to cut down the time that you have to look after, if that's the right word. I don't think it's an appropriate term when you look at how some animals are kept. But shall we say, in the time that you're having to fork up money to keep your animal alive before you turn it into a commodity that you can sell.
Okay. So, in your article in the October edition of Cambridge News, you've actually gone through a whole recipe. So I'd like to, if we could run through that.
Yes.
The recipe is for... Now, I can't remember the name that you used there. I'd never heard of that before. You talk about something called a skirt steak.
Yeah, or hanger steak. Well, skirt steak, I think a lot of... actually, this is probably nice for you to hear. I think you might be a bit too young to have heard skirt.
Really? I love you.
when a carcass hangs and is obviously being cleaned out and it's hanging in the butchers, then there will be two sort of flaps hanging down the sides, if you like, of the open carcass that can look a little bit like a skirt because they're slightly sort of flapping, and they are actually a muscle that held in the whole diaphragm, all the innards that have obviously been taken out. And they have a wonderful texture, which is, when cooked, quite similar to, say, beef or pork cheek. It's a muscle, but it's obviously not a weight-bearing muscle. So it's very, very different from a muscle in the legs and the shoulders and so on.
Do the muscles in the legs and so on, do they have to be tenderized longer? Because they're obviously working muscles.
Yes. When you cook something from a weight-bearing part of an animal, your shoulder, your legs, your shins, they have to be slow-cooked. They're utterly inedible otherwise. When you go via certain other muscles and then eventually end up with, say, fillet steak, which is the most expensive one, that hasn't done anything. It's just a kind of padding. It's a saddle. You then get meat that from the minute it hits the heat of your oven or your pan will go from tender to tough. So you cannot get away from that. The more you cook a piece of animal protein that has no ligaments, no fat, no muscle tissue in it, it can only go from being beautifully tender when it's raw to more and more tough, because it's just losing liquid as you cook it and nothing else happens. With the weight-bearing pieces, it's exactly the opposite, which is why you don't really need any skills as a cook, I would say, if you have one of the weight-bearing pieces, which have the potential to come out the juiciest and nicest pieces you could possibly eat, just by slow cooking them.
Right.
Some nice herbs, you know, a few carrots if you have it, maybe some red wine or not. You can just rub it with a little bit of oil, but leave it in a medium to low oven for 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 hours. And you are going to get a beautifully tender, wonderfully sort of melting leg or shoulder from that unyielding hard piece of muscle that you started with. The tender bits, absolutely the opposite. You start cooking them, they're going to get worse.
Okay, so your recipe that you've got in your article in October, it is the opposite to that, though. It's the skirt, or what's the other phrase
ongle,
you use?
Yeah.
The ongle. Mm. Ongle, I thought that was just a word for English then, in French.
yes, well, it's an interesting piece. As I said, it cooks to a texture which is very reminiscent of eating cheeks, but it's actually quite different. So its role has been to hold in, you know, the intestines, if you like. It is the diaphragm. And it is an interesting piece because it's usually sold, hanger steak or skirt steak would have always been sold as a bracing piece by the butcher, something that needs time to break down. But it is just about the only piece on any animal that can either be braced and turn out tender after hours of cooking, or cooked for about 5 minutes in the case of skirt steak. So a little bit longer than you would a normal steak, because it is more fibrous, if you can put it like that. So it needs a bit longer, but it also is absolutely sensationally good, well served, rare. And it's about an eighth of the cost of a piece of fillet steak.
Oh, really?
Has more flavour, a bit more texture to it. So you do need your full set of teeth to chew it, unlike, you know, fillet steak that you could almost eat without cutlery and without teeth. But it gives so much more flavour.
So, is the we've talked about the type of meat. What about the size? The other point I was going to ask you there was with regard to where to get that from. Mm. I'm guessing you wouldn't see that on a supermarket shelf, particularly.
You can now actually.
Would you
see
get it from maybe
steak? But I think
a food
with
counter,
very few perhaps? Exceptions, there are some organic brands sold through the supermarkets that are very good. It's never good quality. I'm sorry, I'm going to be categoric. I've rarely bought a piece of steak or other pieces of a beef animal, I would say, in a supermarket that I have been happy with, unless it is from an organic smaller supplier.
Right.
So you go to a good butcher and you tell them that's what you want. If they haven't got it in that day, then they should be able to get it for you.
Mm. Okay, and what about size? How big a piece would you go for say two people, for example?
Oh, well, if you're buying skirt, as I said, it's a very inexpensive cut anyway. But normally I would say about 150 grams is quite, to me, I think that's a perfectly adequate size of good steak. If you're very greedy, you probably want a bit more, like 200 grams perhaps.
Mm-hmm.
But I think we're not talking, you know, the American sizes where you get sort of a kilo of beef on your plate.
There's a very good restaurant in the centre of Cambridge that do Brazilian steaks, which they come huge. We went there once and they were absolutely enormous. And I did go up to a farm shop, remain nameless, but just on the outskirts of Cambridge, and they were selling steaks there that quite literally, they must have been about a foot across. Mm. Huge, great things they were, really.
Well, that is how they would come, because you have taken that meat from a massive animal. So it's It's just that, you know, normally it gets cut and butchered in different ways. But if you leave certain cuts the way they are, if you see the muscles that are coming out of an animal that weighs, say, a ton, 800 kilos to a ton, they are big.
Mm. And what about thick or thin? Given that you're saying that what we want to do here is to cook it very rare, would it therefore be the right thing to do to go for a thick steak, perhaps, or not?
It depends on, you know, there are various ways of cooking the French kitchen terms, or, you know, on your plate terms for things like tournedo, say, that is a cut from the fillet, but that is cut very thick. So you're actually standing up as a cylinder, something that is up to 10 centimetres high. So you obviously get a lot of very rare centre on that. If you have something like a rump steak or a sirloin, obviously it's maybe about a centimetre and a half. You cook it for less time then, obviously, because it's going to start to go tough otherwise. So you need to keep, obviously, the thinner the piece, the less time you want to cook it.
And how about preparation? What would you do in advance of actually cooking it?
So I would take it out of the fridge about half an hour before you want to cook it, because obviously if you put a very cold steak or chicken breast or whatever it is into a hot pan, it will immediately lower the temperature, and then you run the risk of just stewing it. So it's going to be slightly grey and really unappetizing looking, rather than caramelized and brown. So you need something at room temperature that goes into a hot pan.
All right, that's interesting as well. I just read something somewhere that said also, if you don't allow it to get up to room temperature, it'll cook unevenly. So the inside, perhaps, or rather the outside, will cook faster than the inside as a result of it still being very chilled.
Well, the outside would always cook faster in that is in touch, isn't it, with a hot pan, whereas the inside isn't.
But even more so if it's a very chilled steak, you know, if it's literally just come out the fridge.
It would need longer to cook, obviously, but you wouldn't get, above all, what you want with a steak is you want that lovely dark brown caramelized surface that gives you a lot of the flavor, which then contrasts beautifully with just an almost raw center. And if you don't have the right temperature on the meat when it goes in, you get that really, I think, horrid looking grey, slightly wet surface. And the other thing that will create that unwanted grey stewing effect is salt. So if you salt your steak while it's sitting there coming up to room temperature, the effect of salt on any protein, whether it's a vegetable or an animal protein, fish, chicken, steak, pork, it will draw out liquid from that protein and it will make the surface slightly wet. So by the time it's sat with the salt on for, say, half an hour, it's actually going in the pan wet, and then you get the same stewing effect. So the salt should go on just before it goes in the pan.
Oh, right. Oh, that's interesting. And you also mentioned in your article about brushing with sunflower oil. Yes? Not virgin olive oil or anything of that nature?
No.
Why was that?
Well, sunflower oil costs next to nothing, and it's a completely neutral flavour, and it can it has a very high burn point, so you're not going to overheat it, if you like, where some of the refined oils have a lower burn temperature. So I just use them for drizzling and for their superior flavour. But when it comes to frying, I would do sunflower oil. And then if you like the flavour to be more buttery, then just before the steak comes out, put in a knob of butter and just scoop the melted butter over it. It will absorb that flavour. But if you try to keep butter in a pan for too long at a high heat, as you know, it just goes black and acrid, and it's got a lower burn point than the oil, so you can't really use that for frying at a high heat.
And what about marinating a steak? Would you recommend that?
No, because the role of marinating is to tenderise. So your steak doesn't need tenderising. You're already cooking with the most tender piece. But marinate all the other slow cook cuts, you know, the legs, the shoulders. They're wonderful to marinate.
Okay, so how should it be cooked? That's the next thing. How long? Under a grill or in a frying pan? What would you recommend?
Oh, for a steak, I would always recommend a hot pan, you know, on the hob. I don't know if anyone's shown you the test for doneness, but if you put your index finger and your thumb together without putting any pressure on it, like showing a little knot in the air, the thick muscle, fleshy muscle at the end of your thumb is still incredibly soft. That's what the French would call bleu. So the surface has had a little bit of frying and the rest is totally raw. Your middle finger held with your thumb, that muscle is tensed up a bit, so that's rare to medium rare. Your ring finger and the thumb, much firmer, so you're now getting to medium to well done. And if it feels like your little finger and your thumb, then it's ready for the bin, if you ask me.
Okay, so let's just go through that again. So your thumb and your index finger,
yes, that's held together loosely, not with any pressure.
The finger next to your thumb, that would
that muscle
at the base of your thumb, the softness of that is...
That's how rare steak feels.
Okay, the next finger, so that's a second finger from your thumb.
Much firmer, isn't it?
Much firmer, so that's a medium?
Mm.
test, and then the third finger is
getting
well done.
Well done. Right. And then the third, I think, you wouldn't want to eat it.
Put it in the bin.
In fact, I wouldn't want to eat it with the last three. I would only want the first one if it's steak, because
you are
just ruining a beautiful tender. As I said, when you're talking about tenderness, as we are here, it can only go from excellent to worse with steak. There is no other way. When you're talking flavour, that will come from a very, very hot pan in contact with the surface for a little while to caramelise it. With the slow cooks, it's the opposite. You cannot eat them. It's impossible. And they have no flavour and they're absolutely chewy and unpalatable unless they've cooked for a long, long time. So if you want to be a frugal cook, you would just go for the cheapest possible cut and cook it for a long time.
Okay. So that interesting point there, I think, is that years and years ago, I think everybody or a lot of people would perhaps tend to cook steaks to within an inch of their life, so to speak. Mm. I think as a nation, we've become much more accustomed to the idea of cooking steaks for less time, and as you say, the benefits are great. I mean, apart from it being much more tender, I generally find that it's much more juicy as well. Mm. and also tastier as well.
Well, we're talking juiciness. That's a misconception that we get asked it all the time, saying, so of course I'm searing it, so I'm sealing in the juices. You are not. When you sear and pan fry, you do one thing only, and that is you caramelize the surface so that it will taste, smell and look better. To keep the juices in, you need to rest your meat. And I cannot emphasize enough, it's almost the most important thing. Even a steak, if you can rest it for at least 10 minutes, then all the juices will go back into it. Otherwise, they're going to be on your plate or on your board when you cut into it. So resting for at least 10 minutes.
At room temperature?
Yeah.
Okay.
Not in the pan, because then it continues to
cook. No, but I was thinking maybe if you had grilled it, could you turn the grill off and then just leave it with the grill door open?
No, it needs to come out. Otherwise, if you probe a piece of steak, whether you put it under the grill or you've got it in your pan, once you take it off the direct heat, you will see that your temperature probe is still going up. So you need to stop it from cooking any further by just getting it away from the source of heat.
But it will in itself cook a little bit longer anyway.
So you always take things out of the pan just before you think that it's going to be cooked enough. And if you like rare steak like I do, and it's not a particularly thick steak, you're probably only cooking it for a minute and a half in all.
Right, that was my next question. So in terms of, you know, we've done the test on our thumbs there, but what about in terms of time for, I guess, let's say, I don't know, a steak of perhaps a couple of centimetres thick, maybe?
Well, the thumb test is very good because you're trusting how it feels when you gently press it. And that is an absolute, you know, that is how it feels. And you will know whether it's raw or more well done. When it comes to how long, that's always a difficult question for any chef because it depends. It depends on the temperature of your meat. Is it actually at room temperature? Is it going in a bit colder? Is the pan very ferociously hot or is it actually just medium hot? How thick is your steak? It could be anything from quite thin to really thick. They're all, you know, it's very difficult to say categorically, but if you want a rare piece of steak, to the touch, it needs to feel very, very soft. The firmer your protein gets, the more you are cooking it, and there's no turning back by then.
Right.
So assume a minute and then start probing from there.
And would you always turn the... How long would you leave the pan on for before you actually put the meat in? Quite a long time so the pan's really, really searing hot?
I would always put a dry pan on and let it get really, really, really hot. And then I'll put a little bit of oil in the pan or, as I said, brush it on the meat. And then leave the meat well alone. Don't start to move it around in the pan. You almost need to force yourself to hold your hands on the back, I think, and just keep them crossed and not, you know, don't move that piece of steak all the time.
And only once on one side and then turn it over. Yeah. Don't go back to doing it a second time on the first side, no? Mm. Okay, what about so we talked about the meat. The other thing in your article is a sauce, which I think was a béarnaise sauce.
Yes.
Is that kind of correct?
Béarnaise,
okay.
So from Bern, the city of Bern.
Oh, right, in Switzerland, okay.
Yes.
So tell us a little bit about what the ingredients, first of all.
Ingredients are mainly egg yolk and butter, and then the classic flavouring ingredient. In fact, if you do egg yolk and butter and make this sauce with just a little bit of lemon, you have a hollandaise, which, as we all know, is a sort of fish sauce, lovely poached salmon. The difference is with this sauce is that you add chopped tarragon. But the sharpness to cut through such a sauce, this is a classic warm emulsion sauce. You know, mayonnaise is your classic cold emulsion sauce. A hollandaise, which was invented first, and then that got developed into béarnaise by adding tarragon, is you make a little reduction. So you've got a small saucepan and you put half white wine vinegar and water, a few peppercorns. If you've got some blade mace, that's great to use. You don't have to have it. I always put a sprig of my tarragon in as well. And then you reduce it down to about a small tablespoon's worth. So you've got 2 or 3 tablespoons of water and white vinegar when you start. And then you put it on open pan, no lid. And you need to watch it because you turn your back on it and it's actually reduced completely and there's nothing left in the pan. So you want to just reduce. So you're reducing water in it and it's becoming more intense. But by adding the vinegar in that way, rather than just raw straight into your sauce, it just is a little bit more mellow and not quite as aggressive and harsh. So you have a little reduction in a glass bowl. Crack an egg yolk into that. Sit it over, not in, a pan of simmering water. So that's a typical bain-marie. It's steaming, if you like, steam heating it, indirect heat. And then you start adding cold butter and little knobs and you stir quite vigorously, moving it so the molecules get moved around. It's very important. So you're burning off all the calories that you're going to take on board when you eat this sauce, because you have anything from half a pack to almost a pack of butter in it, depending on how many portions you're making.
You sound like James Martin. Butter and olive oil. Yes, it's his two favourite things, isn't it?
But you don't need very much of it. And then you put in, it will then, by agitating, an emulsion sauce works with the egg yolks are the magic ingredients. Egg yolks are a natural emulsifier, so they have this ability to bind a liquid with fat. And agitation is very important. So you stir as you do it. The heat helps as well. And then your very liquid, yellowy sauce, as you can imagine, that you start out with, becomes beautifully fluffy, like a mayonnaise. And you then stop and you add your chopped tarragon. And I personally think it is just one of the most delicious things to eat. Would you like to try your
I would, yeah. I was just.
And it may not be rare anymore because I wrapped it in foil and travelled over here. So as I said, the inner temperature keeps going up. So you may find that it's not as rare as I would like it.
Tina's referring to the fact that she's brought in a steak for me to try. So I'll bring it over here.
I'm very intrigued to see whether it is.
Is this a béarnaise sauce? We've got in there as well? Oh, yes, mm-hmm. I can see that. Hang on. I have to do it very quickly and not put too much in my mouth. But.
So for me, to have that on a Friday night with a good glass of red wine or two, I think it's just bliss, really. And it's a 10-minute meal.
That's right.
It's actually a 1-minute meal if you're just talking the steak. It's just the sauce takes a few more minutes to make.
I'll try.
Bon appétit.
Mm. Oh, yes, very tender. Mm. Lovely. And juicy, too.
Mm-hmm. Mm. And have you found your sauce?
I have. Oh, yes, yeah. There's some of that on, too.
Mm-hmm. Good.
Listen, Tina, thanks ever so much for coming in. I shall continue with that during the news, which is coming up very, very rapidly. Thanks ever so much for coming in. We'll see you next month. All right. That's Tina Roach from Cambridge Cookery School. I shall carry on with the steak.